Okay, this is beginning the interview with John Galt on 6 June 1973 at Onsala. Right, now you said that you didn't get involved in radio astronomy until 1958 or something like that.
Yes.
And exactly how was that?
Well, I went to Georgia Bank to do postgraduate work and got involved with the hydrogen line group there. The telescope was not actually operative when we first got there, but it was by the time we left. And we worked with...
Well, you're talking about the Mark 1?
Yes,
Mark?
Yes. The steelworkers were still working on it, and though there were receivers on it in the early stages when they were still pointing at the zenith, the astronomers didn't have it until several months after I got there.
In your previous training, had that been in astronomy?
No,
or radio?
It was in physics, with a smattering of electronics, but not basic.
How did you choose Chapel Bank then?
Well, let's see. I wanted to get into radio astronomy. I had been interested in astronomy, and I had a background interest in radio too. So I wrote to Cambridge, Leiden, and Georgia Bank, and Georgia Bank was the first one to reply positively. So I'm
okay. Okay, so now what did you do at Georgia? You say the dish
well,
working.
I spent most of the time making receivers for hydrogen line with the idea of measuring the Zeeman effect at the 21 centimeter line. And of course, a real definite Zeeman effect was not discovered until a good many years later. We were the first to try. The amount of money that went into the steelwork compared to the amount of money that went into receivers was much bigger. It was a little bit of a shock to see the way they operated. We were working in little huts, smaller than this building here, but they were electrically heated.
Mm.
And whenever there was a power shortage, the amount of power would phone us up and tell us to turn off our soldering irons. How we were supposed to do electronics without soldering irons wasn't obvious.
Yeah.
Now,
you say the Zeeman effect. What did you have? Very narrow band filters? And
we had, yes. We hoped to have... we switched. We had one narrow band filter, and we switched between the two sides. Mm-hmm. The narrow absorption ion Cassiopeia, and there was nothing short of above the noise. And actually, when Verschuer finally discovered it, it was 10 or 20 times lower than our noise level.
And did you publish that experiment?
Yes.
Mm. Okay, and anything else at Java?
Jennison was probably the most clever person there. He was working with hydrogen line receiver then, but he had, before that, been working on the early post-detection correlation interferometers. And his antennas were still around at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they were ever used since, but he tells one story of losing a whole outstation to thieves. They took the antenna and the power generator and the receivers and everything.
It must be hams or something.
Well, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well then after a year at Java.
Yes, I went back to Penticton. Well, not back to, I had never been there. Penticton was just starting, and I had gone to Java because there was nothing much doing really, while the government was acquiring the land and negotiating the contract and building and so on.
Who was the guiding light behind the...
Jack Locke. Jack Locke talked Dr. Beals, who was then the Dominion astronomer, into doing something in radio astronomy, and it was really, well, something more than solar work.
That was all that had been done in Canada?
Up until when, solar work, yes. There were, I think John Bolton gave a series of lectures. Todd Walker. Did you get the name correct? I'm not sure whether it was Bolton or Posse. I think it was Posse. I wasn't in on the movies before I joined the observatory, but this sort of kindled the interest, mm-hmm. and it was the appropriate time to start pressing.
Yeah.
And we got the money for a 25-meter telescope and the one building and a staff of two or three to begin with, which within a few years grew to, I guess the maximum was about 16 or 17. And we have been more or less independent up there, though tied to some group in Ottawa.
This is, now you went there in 59.
Yes, Jack Locke was there for the first 3 years, and he went back to Ottawa.
And then the first thing that was there was the single dish.
Mm-hmm.
And what
was that? Well, we had a hydrogen line receiver with just a crystal mixer at first, and then we got an Adler tube paraff, which was really very good. I think we're the only people who have used them consistently for a long time. It required very little maintenance, but it wasn't the ultimate noise temperature. And we made hydrogen line maps of a number of regions in the sky around suspected associations. Unfortunately, we had only one channel, and we made them over and over again 5 different times.
Yeah.
It was tedious. But then we got interested in low frequency work with the sunspot minimum coming, and we built large low frequency antennas that one 10 megahertz and one 22 megahertz with the beam widths between a degree and a half, so that we had very high resolution at that rate,
mm-hmm. those frequencies. Yeah. Well, that was the best in the world, wasn't it, that array?
Yes. All the data hasn't come out yet from the last sunspot minimum. Although it's nearly finished.
What? Was there a loss of interest in the single dish?
Or? There wasn't so much a loss of interest, but we felt that the sunspot minimum wouldn't wait and that we were committed to this other thing. And so we were doing a continuum survey, which required very little effort. We were simply doing drift scans all day.
Right.
We mapped the sky at 1420 and made a source list, which has been built. A number of those regions have been reobserved and remapped.
Mm-hmm.
And that was being done during the years that we made the we made the low frequency arrays. And then after that, we used the telescope for long based time interferometry and pulsar loop.
What got you interested in doing interferometer as opposed to the single dish? I'm trying to understand why you shifted to the.
To the supersynthesis?
No, to the low frequency.
Well, that wasn't interferometer. It was a
beam. Oh, it was only, I see.
They were T-shaped instruments.
I see.
So that we had, we could map the large features as well as the small ones.
I see.
Well, Carmen Costain was the one who pushed that. He had done 38 megahertz work at Cambridge, and this was one step farther on, and then that was 22 megahertz. Later we decided to go all the way and go to 10 megahertz as well. And so we had two large antennas running in the spot.
Hmm. Well, in fact, at such low frequencies, what other work has been done besides from Reber's
there's
classic
the,
stuff?
The work in Australia. And Tom Clark, who's I think the Goddard
now, yeah,
had
yeah.
A smaller array at 10 megahertz in Boulder.
Awesome.
He did his degree work there. And he was able to see I'm not sure exactly, but 5 or 10 brightest sources only. And we were able to actually map the galactic plane, see the absorption ridges, and several hundred odd sources.
What was your main goal?
Well, different people who were in it had different goals. Initially, it was simply to map the galactic background, looking for to get further data on the spectrum of the background to see if the halo and the plane were different spectra, and also to look for the H2 absorption along the plane, mm-hmm. which appears in emission at high frequencies, and this is one way of seeing H2 regions that hasn't been fully exploited yet.
Yes.
Actually, the results from that have been useful in interpreting pulsar dispersion measures to change them into distances mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah.
And then there was the other interest in simply getting more points on the spectra of more radio sources to try and see if there was a particular characteristic for a quasar. For instance, one knew that 3C84 had turned over by the time we got to 38 megacycles and mm-hmm. was heading down. Now, we wanted to know whether this was a characteristic of quasars or whether we would ever see the turnover. And in most cases, we didn't see a turnover. The spectrum still going up to 10 megacycles.
Well, how many sources did you get at low frequencies?
A few more than 100 at 10 megahertz, and depending on how far down into the noise you go, several hundred at 22 megahertz. I think 200 have been published, and the rest of it is being used.
Now, one thing that I'm interested in is the first VLBI, which was done in Canada, mm-hmm. and which was between Penticton and... Was it the 120-foot dish, actually, or another dish? Or can you tell me about
46-meter dish. The thing was done in several stages. The first stage was done entirely in Algonquin Park with the 46-meter dish and almost right beside it. A much smaller dish, about 20 meters. Mm-hmm. And they were connected up as an interferometer, but with completely independent tape recorders and so on. And they were operated as an analog interferometer in real time, and then simultaneously records were made. And when the recordings were played back in synchronism, the actual noise on the record was the same in the two, so that we were then convinced that the technique would work, and there was nothing intrinsic in the experiment which would be worse if we had moved farther away.
Yeah. Now, who is we, and when is this taking place?
It would be about 67, I guess.
Oh, is that late, this first part?
Yes.
It's actually, okay.
66, maybe. These are things that could be checked.
Yeah.
Well.
Okay, so it's a little bit past the deadline I was telling you about, but nevertheless, I'd like to hear about it.
The main people behind that, well, the names are on the papers, but Helen Yen of Toronto and Herb Gush, who was in the physics department of Toronto and helped to push it in the initial stages, but didn't continue with it. Jack Locke, Norm Broughton, and myself, and Don Chiswick, who since died, he was at Queen's. And other men, senior people.
Now, what about the philosophy of doing it in an analog fashion, as opposed to the digital fashion that's known in the States?
Well, I think the philosophy was simply that when the technology had already been developed to do the experiment at 4 megahertz bandwidth by the television industry, tape recorders had been made that could maintain the necessary time-based stability
mm-hmm.
just for the entertainment industry, and we felt that there was very minimum amount of equipment extra required. And in fact, we got VTAP old tape recorders that were discarded by the CBC, and we simply beat them into working and used them for a number of years before they were replaced with anything better.
I see.
But they you always win in band.
Yeah.
And we could then go to a much lower flux level. There was no large cost in computing to do the correlating, because the correlating is analog and came out automatically. One could still make corrections in playback for any mistakes you made in curving, depending on the sound stage.
Right.
Well, there's been a lot more work done with the digital systems, but this is partly because more people working in state science. I still think that we get bandwidth much more easily in the analog fashion.
Yeah. Okay, well, to go back, you said that once you had proved it would work on a short baseline, and then was it just the next job to transcontinental?
Yes and no. Incidentally, there is a historical article about this in article by McKinley, who is sort of two or three stages up above the soldering iron in the Research Council. It's in Science Forum, which is a Canadian publication.
Science Forum.
You may not know it, but it's just a Canadian publication. It's about issue number 6. The publication only began in the late 1960s.
And this is on the history of the VLBI in Canada.
It's D.W.R. McKinley is his name. Hmm. And he tells a few little anecdotes, including this one, that when we decided that the thing would work with the two telescopes in the same backyard, we had the option of going a moderate distance away or going clear across the continent. And we thought we'd be adventurous and we went clear across the continent. But when we played the tapes, we didn't get anything. And we were quite discouraged and so on. So we decided that we had been overly ambitious, or maybe that the sources were all resolved.
Yeah.
So we brought all the apparatus back from Penticton to Ottawa, and we had a very modest baseline of just 100 kilometers or so between Ottawa and Ottawa. And a small telescope, but still a little. And we saw fringes on every source we looked at. So while we were doing these, the people got proficient in finding fringes in the noise, and in both the odds and ends were to do.
Yeah.
And then, just for fun, they played back a tape from pair of tapes from Ottawa or Algonquin, and sure enough, they were fringes on that. So we didn't really have to, from Penticton, Algonquin.
Yeah.
So we didn't really have to bring all the apparatus back.
It was just a matter of learning the technique.
It was partly practice, and there were two or three little things, an oscilloscope, double beam oscilloscope that had a 2 microsecond offset that nobody knew about.
Little things like that.
Yes.
Yeah, just from my limited experience with water vapor VLBIs, I know it's a fine art searching for fringes. Okay, well, is there anything else prior to 65 or so that is a significance to Penticton? I think that I should know about.
Probably not.
Who is the best person to talk about for the Algonquin Park
development? The person in charge now is Jack Locke. But Jack didn't come on the scene in Algonquin until a bit later. Ron Broughton, I guess. He knows the ins and outs of the
hazard. Right.
And Bill Cummings, who was a antenna engineer,
Covington should definitely be.
Yes, although mainly for the solar.
Right, I mean for solar radiation. Yes, I'm just talking about Canadian.
Too much interest in the in the course.
Right. Of yeah, I'm just thinking mainly about just Canadian astronomy, radio astronomy. Mm. Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
That interview is the interview with John Galt on June 6, 1973, at Onsala.